Okay, today is July 21st, and this is Adam Gregg interviewing Eugene Aldridge about his World War II experiences. Okay, Gene, could you start out by just stating the date and place of your birth?
I was born in Cherokee, Iowa on June the 28th, 1917. I celebrated my 88th birthday last month.
Okay, and where did you live growing up?
Lived mostly in Boone, Iowa. Moved to Haywarden my senior year in high school and graduated from high school here.
Okay, and what year did you move to Haywarden then?
1933.
Okay, and then what did you do? Did you work then, enter the workforce after graduation from high school here before the war?
I graduated in June of 34 and started hitchhiking around the country.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I started for California in 1935. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any job. I didn't have any skills. And I got as far as Columbine, Wyoming. And I got a job in Columbine, Wyoming, as a handyman for $1 a day in my board and room. And I stayed in Columbine that summer and came back to Haywarden when the weather got bad.
Okay, and then what did you do after that?
I stayed in Haywarden until the next summer, hitchhiked down to Boone, Iowa, borrowed $10 from my sister, who was one of the few employed in the family at that time. Remember, it's the Depression, and there are dust storms, and all the terrible things are happening here. And took off for California again. And I got to California that time. And I managed to find an elderly aunt who was a widow with no children, and she adopted me. Found me a job wrapping rugs in a furniture store. That lasted for 6 months, and then I got a job as a messenger in the Bank of America in 1936, or maybe January of 37, and stayed with the Bank of America for 20 years, including the 6 years that I served in the military. And went from messenger to manager in the Bank of America, manager of a branch.
Okay. Could you describe a little bit more how you and your family was affected by the Depression?
We were poor. My dad had several different jobs, most of them away from home. So my mother took care of the family, basically. There were six boys and one girl. And it was always a struggle to make ends meet. And I felt that the area was under a curse. And we couldn't get jobs. The dust storms were terrible. The grasshoppers were bad. It just seemed like the land was cursed. And I needed to get out. And so that's why I took off when I did. Yeah.
Okay, and can you describe a little bit what your thoughts were as the war was breaking out in Europe, and this is before the U.S. got in?
Okay. I lived with my aunt for 3 years, and then I got married and was married 3 years when the war broke out. I was the first one of my six brothers, five brothers, to be drafted. But eventually all of us were drafted. And I think we all felt that we didn't have any choice, that we were designated to be Army personnel.
Okay, and could you describe to me your thoughts and your feelings and maybe other memories you have of when America was attacked at Pearl Harbor?
I had friends in the military, and one of them was visiting at the time, and he was in the Navy. And of course, he was called back to his ship immediately. And I felt then that I would be, it would be necessary for me to go. And I never doubted it, I never questioned it, I never tried to avoid it. And I don't think any of my brothers did either. They all went when they were called, yeah.
Okay, and what branch of the service did you end up joining?
Well, I had my basic training in the infantry, and then I was assigned to the medical detachment of the 185th Infantry Regiment at Camp Hahn, California. And then we went from Camp Hahn to Fort Lewis, and I was with the medical detachment all that time, and went overseas to Hawaii with the 185th Medical Detachment. On the island of Kauai, where we were stationed, we were there supposedly to defend against the Japanese invasion, which never occurred. I was told that I was eligible to apply for officer candidate school, so I applied while I was in Oahu, and was accepted, and I was only over there for about 4 months before I came back to the States and was sent to Camp Barkley, which is near Abilene, Texas, to Medical Administrative Corps at that time. 90 days in officer candidate school, and I graduated as a second lieutenant. From there on, I was assigned first to Camp Claiborne Station Hospital in Louisiana, and then to a hospital in Texas, and then back to Camp, let me correct that. From that general hospital in Texas, I was sent to a school of field medicine and surgery back at Camp Barkley for 8 weeks. And I was given a diploma as an assistant battalion surgeon because they were short of doctors, and while they had an MD who was the battalion surgeon, they didn't have enough doctors to assign an assistant. So I was given this diploma certificate and sent out to a medical detachment back at Camp Hahn, California, with a self-propelled artillery battalion, the medical detachment with that battalion, in Camp Hahn for further training.
Okay. What led you to go into medicine then?
The same thing, reason why I was drafted. They needed people in those areas, and I was willing to go into that service. I liked it better than the infantry because I felt it was constructive instead of destructive, and I never regretted that at all.
Okay, you trained in a number of places, it sounds like.
Yes.
Could you?
From Camp Hahn, we went back to Hawaii, and then Hawaii, we went to Okinawa, and Okinawa was my only really campaign. Our artillery battalion landed at D plus 12 on Okinawa the day that President Roosevelt died. We went ashore, and we were ashore for the rest of the campaign from April the 12th until the campaign actually ended in October. But the Japanese didn't surrender at that time, yeah. And we were being trained for an invasion of Japan after the war ended on Okinawa.
Okay, let's stick with that training. Could you describe some of those training experiences that you had?
Basically, I always worked with a physician or a doctor, and I never was called on to do anything serious in the way of treatment without a doctor being available to advise me. So the GIs, I felt, really lucked out. They didn't have to depend on me for primary care. But in World War II, the evacuation system for the medical casualties was so poor that they were taken from the battlefield on litters by people carrying them to an aid station, given first aid, and then to a collecting station where they were given some additional aid, and then to another station for further care, and then evacuated to a hospital. But it would take some time, several weeks or months, to get out if they were seriously injured. So it was very, very poor system. And my unit on Okinawa was very, very fortunate because we had destroyed that island pretty much of almost everything with our naval and air bombardment. So there was no, the Japanese had no artillery left to speak of, and what they had was very, very weak. So the campaign ended up with the Marines and the infantry fighting the Japanese from hill to hill with small arms and flamethrowers to get them out of the caves that they holed up in, and it was a terrible campaign. The total casualties on Okinawa, including 160,000 civilians, was over 300,000. 110,000 Japanese, 12,000 of our troops killed and 36 wounded. And that was on a little island that was about 35 miles wide and 60 miles long, if you can imagine the number of unburied bodies on the ground in that campaign. Unbelievable. And my experiences included a typhoon, which we escaped by hiding in a cave, but our camp was destroyed. All the tents and everything was just gone. So we had to rebuild it. And then after the Japanese left the island, they hadn't surrendered, but they had left the island, my brother was flying a cargo plane from the Philippines to Japan, and he had to refuel on Okinawa. So he stopped to see me because I was close to the airfield where he was refueling, and I got permission to go to Japan with him and come back on his way back to the Philippines. And so within 30 days after the Japanese surrendered, I flew over Hiroshima, and Nagasaki, and I saw Mount Fuji from the air and had what I thought was tremendous experience for me to see all that. And the rubble and the devastation on those two cities, unbelievable. You can't describe it. And then shortly after that, a passenger plane flying 39 Japanese interpreters tried to land at Naha and overshot the airstrip and crashed. And the battalion surgeon and I were called from one of our artillery units to tell us about that, and we went over to see if we could help. The plane was still burning. The flares in the flare box were going off. It had crashed in the coral, and bodies were just strewn all over the edge of the island, and the tide was coming in. And so the doctor and I worked for, it seems forever, but maybe 2 hours or longer, extracting the bodies from the coral up onto dry land. But there were no survivors. Nobody survived that crash. And for somehow, some way, somebody wrote that up, and he and I were awarded the Soldier's Medal, which is my highest award by far. It is the highest award for non-combat courage that the military hands out. And I have that award, which I prize highly, although I didn't think I deserved it because we didn't save anybody, which would have been wonderful if we had, yeah.
Okay, I'd like to explore Okinawa a little bit. What was it like when you arrived there?
When we landed, we marched up immediately up on the hillside and dug trenches to stay in. That location oversaw the harbor at, as I recall, it was Kadena Harbor. And the troops were coming in there, and the Navy was congregating in there. And at nighttime, the Japanese started sending in kamikaze planes to destroy our fleet in the harbor. And it was the darndest fireworks show I've ever seen in my life. I mean, the kamikazes coming in, the anti-aircraft firing up, the planes and the ships all firing at each other. It was just, and it went on for more than half the night. And that was the first night I was ashore. And that was the most impressive because we moved then north from there and away from the harbor. And after that, we were subject to some artillery fire at night, but we had very few casualties in our unit, in our artillery unit. It was a self-propelled automatic weapons battalion. And from then on, we just moved forward as the troops moved forward, probably to 3 locations. And then we got word that the last of the Japanese were jumping off the cliffs at the end of the island and committing suicide rather than be captured. And that the total number captured on that island after 110,000 were killed was less than 50 that surrendered.
And you mentioned this campaign was pretty brutal. What was the fighting like day to day?
I understand today it's a beautiful island. I have never been back, but I've wanted to go back. But I've talked to people who have been back, some in the military and some not, and they say it's a beautiful island, and it's all restored, and it's modernized, and because there wasn't hardly a building standing when that campaign ended, everything had just been destroyed, including the trees and the bushes and the shrubbery, all gone. It was just bare. But they've recovered.
So, with such devastating combat going on, what did that mean for a person in your position?
Well, I was fortunate in that my outfit never came under small arms fire or flamethrowers. Those were the infantry and the artillery. And we went out and helped the medics in the infantry and the artillery on occasion when they would ask for help. We would go help. But they were very competent themselves, and they didn't call on us too much at all.
And when they asked you for help, what would that entail?
Well, it would be mostly an evacuation, either using our ambulances or our jeeps or whatever we had available to help them evacuate their wounded.
What do you suppose it was that influenced you to keep going in your time in the service? What was kind of your motivation?
I think there was very little internal motivation. You were told where to be, when to be, and how to do what you had to do, and you followed your instructions. There really wasn't much motivation for what you did. You were just taking orders, period.
You mentioned you were lucky enough not to come under small arms fire, but you did, I assume you were subject to some kind of artillery fire?
Yeah, at night, not in the daytime. Somebody would have to show you a picture, I think, of Okinawa, because that civilization took the coral out of the ocean and built tombs in the hill for their deceased people. And they had hundreds, maybe thousands of those tombs built of coral, which is very, very tough rock. And the Japanese had decided to use those tombs, we called them, to hide out in. And they would stay in there in the daytime, and then they would wheel out what little artillery they had left and fire at night. And most of the firing that we heard went over us. We were close enough, so they were lobbing shells over us. And that happened every night for quite a while, but eventually that stopped. And then it was all up to the infantry and the Marines to get them out of those tombs, and that's why they had to use flamethrowers so much, because they couldn't get them out any other way.
So what did you do when you heard those artillery shells?
We had all built, well, I would call them slit trenches rather than foxholes, where we could lay down in them and go to sleep if we could, and that was our refuge, where it's a type of foxhole, but it's not a deep one down, yeah.
What were your feelings towards the enemy?
That's very difficult. I didn't think about them too much. I sort of empathized with them because they wouldn't surrender. And I felt it was such a waste of life for them, for instance, to jump off of the ocean when you don't, when you could surrender and live. But their philosophy was that was a disgrace to surrender, and they wouldn't do it. So I felt especially when I heard about them jumping off, and there were a lot of them that did that. What a waste of life it was for them. And I knew they had families, and all they were humans too. So I had quite a bit of empathy for them, but I guess it was based upon the fact they were so, I don't know what it is, indoctrinated with their philosophy that they wasted their lives. But I never felt any hatred for them, although I know that in some of the islands, their atrocities were unparalleled, yeah.
Were there a lot of casualties in your unit?
No, very few, very few.
And did you ever have friends that were missing or killed?
Very few. I had one friend who in the Navy that was killed, and I'm trying to think now. Very few, and none of my brothers. A couple of them were wounded slightly, but nothing seriously. So I really didn't have any close friends or family involved, yeah.
And where did your brothers serve?
Oh, all kinds of things. Four of them were in the European theater. My brother Bob and I were the only ones, one that was a flyer, in the Pacific. One of them ended up as a master sergeant operating a train delivering supplies to the front in France. And one of them was an infantryman who was slightly wounded in Italy. The two others were stationed in England, one in maintenance, and I'm not sure about the youngest one, what he did. He was only over there a short while before the war ended, and I don't know what he did over there.
Okay, you mentioned your soldier's medal. Did you get any other medals or citations?
Well, I have quite a few medals. You've seen them on the, and I think there's about 10 altogether. But most of those are medals acknowledging your presence at a certain place at a certain time. There's a Korean Occupation Medal, there's a Korean Defense Medal, there's a United Nations Medal, there's a Pacific Campaign Medal, there's, anyway, there are about 10, but the only two that I feel have special meaning are the Soldier's Medal and the Korean Presidential Unit Citation. And while that is not a personal award, it was my unit that I commanded that was received that citation. But it was pinned on me by Syngman Rhee, who was the first president of South Korea. And that's why I really treasure it more than the others.
Okay, what would you say was your single greatest fear during your time in the service?
I don't think I had one. I don't think I had one. I accepted the fact that I could be in a position of danger, but I never really worried about it.
Why do you suppose that is?
Because I remembered this prayer. Give me the grace to change the things that I can change. Accept the things I cannot change and the knowledge to know the difference. And that was my philosophy. I couldn't change anything. I was subject to orders. I had to do what I was told, or I would be, you know, dishonorably discharged, which was out of the question, yeah.
You mentioned that prayer. Was religion something you turned to during your time in the service?
No, this is a prayer that I think it's St. Francis of Assisi. I'm not sure whose prayer it is, and I've read it many times, and I've used it many times myself, yeah.
Okay. You mentioned you have the unique experience of having flown over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What were your thoughts on the use of the atomic bomb?
I felt that President Truman's decision to use those bombs saved my life, because we were preparing for an invasion of Japan. And if you've ever seen Japan from the ocean, you know it's just a jungle, and it goes almost straight up from the ocean, full of whatever, bushes, trees, rock. It would have been almost impenetrable. And they would have been up on the higher levels firing down on us. And they told us when we were in training that they anticipated that there would be over 1 million casualties in the first wave if they had to invade. And they were training us to invade Japan at that time. So I figured that President Truman really saved my life. And I remember when I heard that President Roosevelt had died, I thought, oh my God, Truman's president. We've lost the war. But he turned out to be one of the best presidents we ever had.
What did you think of Roosevelt?
I wasn't in the voting age at his time, but I felt that he did an awful lot to help the country recover from this terrible depression that we were in. The Civilian Conservation Corps, so many things that he did, and in retrospect, they probably didn't do that much good. What really saved our country, I think, was the war, because it brought everybody together, and we all had a common goal. And we were all willing to sacrifice whatever we had for that victory that we had. And I think we sold war bonds to finance it, and everybody was either in the service or working in a industry of some kind related to the war. And I had a lot of respect for him, and I felt really bad when I thought he was being... not being replaced properly.
When you were overseas, were you able to stay in touch with your family?
Let me go back. My salary when I was drafted was $21 a month. And by the time I paid for my GI insurance and my laundry, I had about $8 left. So I couldn't send anything home. Once I got commissioned, then that helped. And I had an allotment to my wife, who was working in the defense industry in California, for her. So I helped take care of her. But Edith stayed here with my mother after all of us were in the service. Edith stayed here and took care of my mother here in Haywarden. So we didn't contribute to her support at that time. I didn't anyway. The other boys might have, but I don't know. I don't think they did, because Edith was taking good care of her, yeah.
Okay, and so you were married at the time that you were drafted?
Yes.
Okay. What was that like to leave your wife behind?
It was wonderful. This was my first wife. Bonnie is my second wife. Bonnie and I have been married 40 years. So my first wife died after we had been married about 24 years. And we had three children. But we had no children when I was drafted. So she went to work with Douglas Aircraft in Long Beach, California. And she made good money. She was a very competent executive secretary. And she did real well. And I I know that I sent money home, but it was all saved for when I would get back and we would get a home and all that, have kids and so forth, yeah.
And were you able to keep in touch with her then?
Snail mail, just regular letters. I had an APO wherever I went, and of course I could write to her, but everything was censored. And they would read your letters before they went out, so you didn't get too far out with them.
What was it like to spend a holiday at war?
Didn't really make any difference. It was just another day. It's like... when I was an enlisted man at Camp Hahn, we had a white glove inspection on Saturday where the officers went through and checked everything, your clothing and your bedding and your foot lockers and so forth. And then they would award what they called a supernumerary. And that supernumerary would get a weekend pass. And I got it one time, but I didn't have any money. I was making $21 a month, and I only had $7 or $8 left, and I would go to the PX and buy a candy bar or something like that. So I didn't go anywhere because I didn't have any money, even though I could have gone if I'd wanted to. But that's the way holidays were. They weren't really different than any other days, because holidays are meant to celebrate with friends and family, and none of the GIs felt like doing that, I don't think.
What was the food like?
Generally, it was pretty good. Field rations, sea rations, that type of thing were monotonous, and but they were nourishing, and we found ways to enhance them a little bit. Once in a while, we'd find a vegetable or something like, I'm trying to think of ham and beans, you know. If you can find a little catsup to put on them, they're not too bad, that type of thing. But I never criticized the military for their food, because the handicaps they had, especially in the field, where they had field setups and these guys working, you know, night and day to get food on the table. And I appreciated that.
Did you feel you had plenty of supplies?
Yes. Yeah, I don't think we ever felt we were short, especially of medical supplies. That was our main concern, and we always had enough.
Did you ever feel pressure or stress, and how did you handle that?
Not to any degree. On Okinawa, they discovered that the Japanese were shooting the medics. Now, in every war, or recent war at least, the medics were not being shot at because we wore big Red Cross signals on our arms and we carried medical pouches, and we were considered not combat, enemy. But on Okinawa, they started firing at them. So they armed us on Okinawa with 45 automatics, and we were given a course in firing them and all, but I never fired mine, never saw a Japanese close enough to fire with an automatic, and and now, after that, they awarded what they called a combat medical badge to medics who were armed, and there weren't And that's the only island I know of where they were armed, where we were armed.
You mentioned the artillery barrages at night, if you can call them a barrage. What else was kind of characteristic of the nighttime?
Our artillery was firing day and night, not consistently, but occasionally day and night, or targets over us. So the artillery was going both, the shells were going both ways. And that's the only thing that I remember about it, is that they were both shooting over our positions, and very few ever landed in our area at all.
What was it like trying to get to sleep?
I don't recall I ever had a problem. Like I say, I felt that fate was preordained, and there wasn't anything I could do about it. So it didn't bother me that much.
Did you ever have much downtime?
Downtime,
free time?
Quite a bit, yeah, quite a bit.
Okay, what'd you do to entertain yourself?
Yeah, well, we played a lot of cards, and we played various games, chess and checkers, and that type of thing. I wrote quite a bit, wrote home to Mom and Edith and to my wife, and I wrote some stories while I was in the service and all. But and when the weather got nice, and of course after the campaign ended, we started getting sun baths because it was nice on Okinawa, on the island, and we could get sun baths on the island. There wasn't any good swimming because the coral was too dangerous. But and then when I got to Korea, there were beaches in Korea that we could go to and get sun baths.
Okay, what kind of stories did you write?
Oh, mostly about things that happened. One I remember was that just before the typhoon hit the island, I had traded, the war had ended, and I had traded a big urn that I got someplace that was a beautiful urn. It was white with a blue scene of sampans and trees around it. And it was probably 36 inches across. And I had traded, they started giving us a monthly beer ration, Australian beer. 12 bottles or cans, bottles. These were bottles. And I wasn't much of a beer drinker. So a GI came along and offered to trade this big, beautiful urn for me for my beer ration. So I made a deal. And about that time, we were told, now, we're going to Korea and we're going to change uniforms from khakis to ODs, winter. From summer to winter gear. And the officers could pack any of their khakis, that was their own gear, and send it home if they wanted to. So I put all my khakis and some extra underwear and stuff I had in this big urn. And I got someone to build a box for me to put it in. And I had it all crated up and had taken it to the post office, which was just a little tent, that's all it was, to send home. And the typhoon hit and it destroyed everything. Our tents, our the post office, the mess hall, everything. Just the wind indicator broke on the airstrip at 170 miles an hour. And so when we came out of the cave, one of the first things I went was go to the post office to see what happened. Well, my big box was still sitting there. It was the only thing left from the post office was this box. So it finally got home. I don't know how long. I think it was a couple of months in transit before it got home. And when I got home, my wife wrote me and said, everything was full of salt water. Everything was soaked. And she said it must have weighed 120 pounds. And so I wrote a story about that. And the way that ended up was interesting because my wife, my first wife passed away and I married Bonnie. And Bonnie really liked this big urn, but she said it had to have a hole in the bottom to drain the water out of it because the water would just stagnate in there. So I took it around into the garage and put it on a ping pong table and went looking for a drill. And while I'm looking for the drill, the cat rolled the urn off the table and broke it into 1,000 pieces. So my urn had a tragic death. But that's just, those are the type of things that I would write about. The landing, the bombing of the harbor, the typhoon, you know, things like that that were unusual.
Do you still have any of those or whatever happened to them?
What's that?
Those stories.
I don't know. I don't know. I